Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of March. There's a very interesting conference, White Privilege Conference, taking place in Madison next week. Over 1,500 people from all over this country and from all different racial groups will be gathering. White privilege is defined as the other side of racism, existing when one group has something of value that is denied to others simply because of the groups they belong to, rather than because of anything that they have done or failed to do. Access to privilege doesn't necessarily determine one's outcomes, but it is definitely an asset that makes it more likely that whatever talent, ability, and aspirations a person with privilege has will result in something positive for them. We have two guests with us this hour. They'll be participating in that White Privilege Conference next week. Debbie Irving has an interesting background. She grew up on the East Coast, you could say a WASP family, pretty well-to-do, very comfortable. She has written a book about her coming to terms with white privilege and with issues of race that actually she started thinking about pretty deeply as a five-year-old child. She is the author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Debbie's now a racial justice educator and writer for 25 years. She sensed inexplicable racial tensions in her personal and professional relationships. As a teacher, found her best efforts to reach out to students and families of color left her wondering what she was missing. And then in 2009, things kind of fell together for her, and she launched an adventure of discovery and her current work on this very important issue. And we thank you, Debbie, so much for being with us. Thanks.
Thank you. I love that introduction.
Oh, thank you. Also joining us is Norma Johnson. And Norma has an interesting history as well. She's a poet, a healer, a teacher, a performance artist. And evidently one of her poems, which we will ask for her to recite sometime during this hour, has been receiving a great deal of attention. For my white friends, I didn't tell you. She grew up in New Jersey. She's lived in the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Maryland, Alaska, is now living in Boulder, Colorado. She's been a professional costumer in the entertainment industry, and she does a lot of dance. She began getting involved in community organizing and race dialogue since she was in high school over 40 years ago. She's worked with black youth in predominantly white communities, and she has done a lot of work helping to bridge this racial divide. She, as I said, was at a white privilege conference a few years ago and was elated to know that about the event, and the people in the audience were elated to hear her poetry as well. Norma, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. We should have a really good hour. I want to start with you. I was reading your book yesterday, Debbie, and it was interesting to me that it seems like you were almost designed at a very early age to be doing what you're doing now, because you had, at 5 years old, this real interest in Native Americans, and you start your book with this story, which I think is very profound and I think led you to your current life in a way.
I do think it led me to my current life. That said, it's amazing. I'm now an adult educator on this topic, and it's amazing how many people have similar stories. And by similar, I mean they noticed something, that they longed for something beyond their own family. And when they would try to make a connection, they would ask a question that was a question born of curiosity, they'd get shh, or they'd get a negative message, and they would get the cue that this isn't something we're going to talk about or be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's all that unique, and I think that might be the appeal of my book, is that I think so many people can see themselves at some point in my, I'm 53 years old now, at some point in my life, at some point in my journey, they'll be able to recognize themselves.
Yeah. What was interesting was all the information. You had the curiosity, but the information, you were too young to go to the library and research it for yourself. But there were big gaps of knowledge, the GI Bill, the plight of people who are Chinese or who are Native American or African American, that was just not available to you. You were living in another world.
I was. And I, you know, my parents are no longer alive, so I can't go and ask them, you know, what did you know and what didn't you know? What were you not telling me because you were trying to protect me? And what were you not telling me because you yourself didn't know? I don't know the answer to that, but my guess is that especially my mother knew very little.
Mm-hmm.
My father, I think, may have known more. He was in the he was an investment lawyer, and I can't believe he didn't know about redlining. And he was in World War II. I can't believe he didn't know that there were black and Japanese American GIs,
right,
who then were not given the same treatment when they came home.
Yeah, or that there wasn't something wrong with a Jewish person wanting to be a member of the country club.
Right. And all of these not knowings, all of this ignorance is very easy to sustain when you're living in an all-white privileged community.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it's a bubble. I think you just used that word, and that's a perfect word.
Norma, tell me about the community. You've lived in many parts of the country. Tell me about the community where you spent most of your time as a child. Was it a mixed community? Was it African-American? Was it privileged? What was it?
Yeah, it was a very mixed community, largely working class in New Jersey, Hackensack, New Jersey, actually. And I had a real curious, kind of interesting situation because at the time I was born, 1953, things were still fairly segregated, even what they call up north. And but around that time, there were starting to be some breakthroughs, and my parents moved from the black part of town, which was very restricted, to another part of town where they were able to buy a house, and it was an immigrant section of town. So I grew up with people from many different countries, mostly European and Eastern European,
mm-hmm.
Largely Italian. And so I got to see... It was curious to me how the difference between the life I knew as a black child and what I saw them living, because essentially they had a very minimized existence as an immigrant, because there were many, many restrictions in terms of they might have had accents or didn't know the language well, they
right.
looked and dressed different, so forth. But their children could change how they were treated just because they were more American.
Mm-hmm.
So that was curious to me.
Mm. So the schools that you went to, would it be fair to say they were pretty integrated?
Yes, kind of.
What does that mean? Yes, kind
yeah.
of.
Well, technically, it was open enrollment. But it was also relegated to neighborhoods.
I see.
So that meant that there were certain populations in each school according to the neighborhood.
And in terms of your education, it was different for your children, and I want you to describe the difference, Norma, but your schools sounded to be pretty much white schools. You were surrounded socially in your neighborhood by people who were privileged people.
Yeah, I would say so, although, you know, that's not, I don't think I recognized it as that, just I noticed there were differences, you know, as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I did go to predominantly white school, at least until I merged with the main population in what was then junior high and then high school, and that was... very mixed.
The book indicates, though, that you were always concerned about these issues of injustice, that there were things that maybe you should have learned when you were younger, but there was no way to learn it when you were younger. So when you were confronted by information about how the GI Bill was not very equitable and didn't give African-American soldiers, returning vets, the same kind of privileges that white people had, that this really outraged you, which I found very interesting. There's a thread of that in much of your life, isn't there? Until you really turned it over and decided that this is what you were going to work on.
Yeah. It's a quietly held existence, being under the thumb of racism. And it's very systemic. It's built into the institutions, and it operates rather seamlessly. But there's always been an awareness of the difference in our lives, because I grew up in a black family, and I knew that my dad went to into service in a segregated military.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about all those things. I grew up knowing about lynchings, and these were real factual things in my life. They weren't just hearsay.
Mm-hmm. And for you, Debbie, your parents wanted to, and from with the best of intentions, wanted to keep you away from the bad that was in this world, so you would not have been as aware of all of that.
So, yeah, I was completely unaware until the age of 48, which, you know, was only 5 years ago. And yet I was teaching in public schools where I was being asked to, you know, educate children and of color and connect with families of color. And that was my second career. My first career was as a nonprofit manager running a big city festival, citywide festival in Boston called First Night, where a big part of my job was to connect the various neighborhoods of Boston with one another and spread the resources around the city. And I couldn't make any sense of what I observed in terms of the racial divide, who lived where, who worked where, who achieved how. So I think when I learned about the GI Bill, which I didn't learn, I always knew about the GI Bill because my parents pointed to it as proof of, you know, this wonderful meritocracy and this wonderful country that cared for its veterans when they came home. And that is true, but that's only part of the story. There were many people of color who were excluded, and I didn't learn that side of the GI Bill until I was 48. And at that point, I was really incensed because I felt, here I have been trying to figure out a problem for 25 years of my career, and if I could have just been operating with real information, I could have probably made a much bigger impact than I did. So I felt that I'd been duped.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's the best word I have for it, just duped.
Yeah. Well, it's all right. You've written a book now, and things are pretty different. It's okay. Norma, you have said that you've also often found yourself in environments with mostly white people, and you've experienced the frustration of the race divide to a great degree. What have you experienced?
Oh, it's I'd say the largest part of it is what now is termed microaggressions. And it's all the little things, or I don't even know if I'd actually say little, because they don't feel like that when they're happening. But the things like being followed around in the store.
Mm-hmm.
Things, the stories that I hear over and over and over and over again from other people of color, from parents of color, or parents of children of color who have to bend over backwards to address things in schools and advocate for their children. They have to advocate for their children all the time. Things like just even being stared at, and people moving away from you, walking down the street, people waiting on a white person first when I was standing at the counter.
Mm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's an accumulation of many, many things at a daily level. And then there's the frustration of addressing services, especially for friends that I know that might not have the level of communication or education that I have, and really are just beaten around with just getting services that many white people just take for granted.
Mm. Is there something, do you feel, I found one of these indications of white privilege to be interesting, that if you are considered an other in this society, if you're not getting all the benefits of white privilege because you're a white person, that you're carrying around the fact that you are African-American, you are gay, you are a person with disabilities, that somehow that's kind of front and center in your consciousness as you go through every day?
Oh, yeah. I have to be prepared. I have to be prepared to face all those things that come my way. Mm-hmm. So it has to be conscious. I'm expected to behave according to white cultural standards. And that doesn't necessarily interpret through other ethnic cultures. And but we have to be bicultural because we have to learn to operate within the dominant culture as well as whatever subcultures that we have. And I'd say that's probably across the board for also for GBLQT and, as you point out, people with disabilities, all those kinds of things. Mm,
that's interesting. And Debbie, I know your life is quite different now, but do you feel a sense that you need to be bicultural now as well? And if so, what form does that take in your life?
Yeah, the biggest change for me is that instead of looking to people who've been labeled as other for answers, I look at myself and I think, you know, that it's this white, these white cultural norms that Norma is mentioning. And I take a look, I spend a lot of time thinking about what am I bringing, what kind of a tone am I setting, what context am I bringing to this relationship. And so, for instance, before waking up, if someone like Norma had tried to tell me about being followed in a store or like access to services, like having it take 3 months to get a, you know, a loan approved, I would have silently thought in my head, you know, must have bad credit, or she must have been doing something to get followed around that store. Mm. I probably wouldn't have said anything out loud, but I certainly would have thought it. And I think that's a vibe that people of color can definitely pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that in itself is a microaggression. And so for me, the big change is now I know to listen. I know it's not a level playing field. So when someone, whether they're of a different sexual orientation or they have some form of a disability or they are living in an impoverished state or they're a person of color, if somehow anybody tries to tell me about an experience that is different than what I am living, I know now to just open my heart and open my mind and listen and learn. And not only do I learn about that person's life, but it shines a different light on mine.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a difference in how you go through the world, doesn't it? Complete
Absolutely.
Difference.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both of our guests, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about white privilege. There's a conference that addresses that subject next week in Madison. Actually, this conference has been getting together once a year for a number of years. So it looks at issues of privilege, of prejudice, of bigotry, of racism, all meaning different things, how it manifests itself now. Even though we do have an African-American president, there are still many manifestations of prejudice and of issues and of certainly privilege and racial advantage. So that's, oh my goodness, we have so many calls. Well, that's good, huh? And we have a lot of Facebook comments, too. So we'll get to those just momentarily. Feel free to join our conversation. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. I am Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have two guests with us as we talk about white privilege, the author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Debbie Irving is with us. She is now a racial justice educator and a writer. Norma Johnson is with us as well. She will be at the conference next week. She's a poet, a healer, a teacher, and also a performance artist who has been taking up I won't ask her about this, although I would love to know about tap dancing because I want to take tap dancing again, and she loves it. She'll inspire me to take tap dancing again. And we're going to ask her to read a poem for my white friends. I didn't tell you coming up during the course of this show. I want to start with a Facebook message because I think it's a good one, and then we'll go to our many phone calls that have come in. This one is from Jim, who says, white privilege, it's growing up without the sense that society and its rules and conventions tilt against you. As a result, you do not have to be smarter, more resourceful, more talented, more determined, and especially more alert to your environment than average to succeed, but sometimes just to survive. It's not just white privilege, it's male privilege, heterosexual privilege, and Christian privilege. What do you think of that? Debbie?
I love that. The key word there is without. So for me, when I hear that, so all the things I didn't have to think about, I just didn't have any of what was just described, which we'll hear about in Norma's poem, because she describes what she does have to deal with, which puts into relief for white people what we don't have to think about. I have a chapter in my book called Headwinds and Tailwinds, which is one of the ways I've come to think about the way racism works in this country. And, you know, if you go out for a bike ride on a beautiful day, if you've got a tailwind, man, you think you are a great bike rider and you just cruise, having a great time. You're not as sore the next day. And, you know, you think it takes, 30 minutes to do that ride. If you had had a headwind, you may well have finished the ride, but you would have had to exert a lot more energy. You would have been sore the next day. You may not have made it all the way to the end. And so that's just sort of a metaphor for it. I think when people look at, we do have a black president, so what's the problem? Well, if you look at the averages, which really tell the story, they're in every sector of our society, white people are achieving more in terms of accumulating wealth, in terms of levels of education, and in terms of longevity, in terms of diseases. The stress that it takes in this country to be a person of color, or any of the other ways in which people are otherized, there's a lot of stress with that, and that takes a toll on the psyche and the wallet and the physical body.
Yeah. And in terms of safety, too, Norma, we had Trayvon Martin's Sabrina Fulton mom with us last week. We've done a lot of shows on Stand Your Ground and racial profiling, et cetera. Just the issue of having to make sure, I've heard so many African-American moms saying they have to have a certain talk with their sons when they reach an age because they are just worried about their safety, and rightfully so. What a thing to have to tell your child.
Yes, that I think is an excellent example of white privilege, where, like Debbie says, there's the with and there's the without. And parents, black parents, parents of color, do have to have that conversation with their children, and it goes on all the time that you're growing up, because, you know, at different stages, you know, age ranges, it has to be interpreted, it has to be shared in a different kind of way when you're very, very young. It's all about caution. You're always getting these messages of caution. Caution about how to behave around white people. Caution about what to do if you're stopped by the police. Caution, caution, caution all the time. And when you're very young, you may not really know, understand what it all relates to, but it's literally life or death. And so it's something that's held very strongly and strictly in families, that you must obey this set of rules, whether you understand it or not.
Yeah. Let's go to some callers. John in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. I was just calling, I live on a university campus, and I'm a person of color, and I often run into white privilege. What's the best way for me to address the white privilege without coming off as aggressive myself or being inconsiderate of the fact that they may not understand their privilege?
That's a good question. And, it's for me, it's one that I still don't have answers for. Not a pat answer. For me, I can only share how I deal with it. Sometimes I don't have the energy, because if people are really unaware, if they haven't woken up or on that path, sometimes what it takes to try and explain, or I have to defend myself, or sometimes the comeback is more than I'm willing to deal with in that moment. So I may not address it at all. Times when I do feel like I want to address it, sometimes I make sure that I'm in an environment where I got some backup, that is another person of color or somebody else that I know understands that could back me up. Or sometimes I'll have just something to give them something to just think about, as opposed to trying to explain something that they don't have enough background or history to understand what I'm referring to. So sometimes I'll just share something that just brings a little light that there's a difference between our lives. And maybe you might want to notice that.
Yeah, noticing things is a good idea. How did you make certain, Debbie, that your children were raised in a different fashion, that your children had their eyes and their hearts wide open?
Well, I was 48, which meant that my children were already, I wish I could do this really fast, but I can't. They were something like 12 and 15 when I started to wake up. And so I had to go back and say, do you remember in the third grade, Emily, you asked me why all the black kids came to school on the bus and why all the white moms picked their kids up? And, of course, there are exceptions to that, but there was a very obvious trend. Or why the black kids were all in the lower reading group, the black and brown kids were in the lower reading groups and the white kids were in the upper reading groups. And I said, I didn't have an answer for you then, but I do now. And so it's never too late to go back to your children and say, you know, I didn't understand something and I do now and I'm learning and I'd love it if you'd learn along with me. If I could start all over. It's, as Norma says, it has a lot to do with age appropriateness. And so that time when my child was 4 years old in the grocery store and said, Mommy, why is that man's skin that color? I wouldn't have said, shh. You know, I would have said, because we're all different colors. You know, look at, you and I aren't even the exact same color. I would have normalized the conversation right from the get-go. And if they asked a question I didn't know, I would have said, you know, I don't know, but let's figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
When my child asked a question about almost anything, I would say, let's go figure it out. When they asked a question about race, I got so panic-stricken and overcome with anxiety by the whole topic that I didn't know the answers, that I couldn't serve them very well.
Norma, is there an African-American parallel to what Debbie just said?
Well, since more than likely I would be on the receiving end of that kind of thing happening. And our children also are being on the receiving end of that. So we might have conversations regarding that being pointed out, being treated differently. I mean, it's quite something for a black youth youth of color to experience maybe standing with their parent while they're questioned, you know, in terms of service, for instance, at a supermarket, and their check is questioned, where the kid might have seen the person before them who's white might not have. So we more have those kinds of conversations.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John, for your call. Let's go next to Lori in Milwaukee. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a comment. I'm married to an African-American man and have four children and four grandchildren. And all these years that I've experienced, I feel bad when my daughters have to go through certain things, and I, even when they were little, I was treated differently. like in stores when I was with them than when I was without them. And I don't see a lot of that has changed very much over all these years.
How are you treated differently?
Just, it was subtle, but just different, the way people talk to you and treat you. And my children were younger, we lived in Neenah, that's where I'm from, and moving to Milwaukee, being biracial, they experienced just so much more racism here than they ever did even in Neenah.
Really?
Because it came from both directions. And we moved here when they were like 10 and 11. And it just, I think they're cynical. They're in their early 20s and, you know, they've experienced a lot of it, and it's just, it's heartbreaking to me.
Mm-hmm. What about Norma, what she just said about her children being mixed, being subject to racism from both African Americans and from whites?
Yeah. You have to keep in mind that when the term racism is used, it can mean a lot of different things according to how people are using it and who's using it. So there's systemic racism, which is built into the systems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the overarching operational piece. So for other people of color, they can be biased against or prejudiced against or just have a chip on their shoulder about someone else regarding race. But racism, you have to have power to be able to implement anything really regarding it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different take coming from either direction. And yes, I mean, the people I know and that I've spoken with, that I know that are of mixed race, have a whole particular set of circumstances and challenges that they deal with in that regard. And I've heard that same comment from many people.
Yeah.
That they just, because our culture is so racially divided, you almost have to fit in one. You have to choose. That's the message you get. You have to choose. So that's where the challenges come in regarding that.
Thank you very much, Lori, for your call. Let's go to Larry in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Larry.
Hello. I share the experiences that some of your callers have had. I grew up mostly in a white area in Wisconsin, and then became a VISTA volunteer in the 60s and got my education in other cultures and other colors. And since that time, I have gone out of my way to make a difference in my white society when I see something that's not right. And most of the time that is accepted, but there are times when you are sort of put into a renegade category. My question is, it would be wonderful if we could, in our schools, have a program that really deals with this in a deep way. The only thing that I can think of is there was an Iowa teacher who took her kids, and those that had blue colors eyes were discriminated against for a week. And this actually taught them. There was this 25 years later, people were calling in and saying they knew how it felt to be discriminated against because they were the blue-eyed ones, and they got in trouble that first week and learned what it felt like to be discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking for things we can do in our schools.
All right, Debbie, you've been in schools.
Yes. So first of all, Larry, is that your name?
Yes.
Yeah. The video that you're the experiment that you're referring to is an excellent one, and I think if listeners are interested in this show, they might want to check it out. Her name is Jane Elliott. She's an Iowa teacher, and the experiment was called Brown-Eyed, Blue-Eyed, or Blue-Eyed, Brown-Eyed. If you Google it, you'll find it. It's free online. It's about an hour, and you can watch it. It's incredible. incredibly informative in terms of how any human being, regardless of color, will upwardly or downwardly constitute themselves based on expectations. So if someone starts harassing you and discriminating against you and thinking less of you, you will amazingly perform worse. And the exact opposite is true. If someone starts elevating you, praising you, telling you you're wonderful, you will perform, you'll rise to that occasion. And the video demonstrates that. Schools are working really hard on this, many of them. That said, other schools are afraid to even bring up the topic. So I see a wide range. I have had experience as a consultant and as a student and as a parent in both public and private schools. And it's interesting to me that private schools are, by and large, way ahead in terms of understanding how to teach anti-oppression, anti-discrimination in the curriculum to children as young as, you know, first, second, third graders, and addressing it at the staff level. So I have been very impressed with independent schools across the country, and I think a lot of colleges are also taking it on. And that said, there's a lot more to be done. When you get into the public school arena, there are politics involved. And as we see in politics all over our country, you know, racism, race, oppression, those are words that politicians don't like to use. And I don't know how to make progress without having honest conversations. And I think this is what the White Privilege Conference is attended heavily by educators. And it's there where there's an understanding. If you've come to this conference, this is a space where we are going to speak very openly because it's the only way to understand. If we don't hear Norma really describe what her experience is like and hear me describe how easy it is to become as ignorant as I was, we don't know where the gap is and how to address it.
Hmm.
And the White Privilege Conference has taught me so much about where my learning edge is in terms of a white person. And so I think there's hope, Larry, because I do think that schools are working on it, but we really need to get to a point in this country where we can speak honestly.
Well, I think another of the problems, and I'd like for both of you to address this, and Norma, if you would start, this may be something that's more important to me as a white person than it is to African Americans, and I know there's been a big controversy about this issue in terms of schooling, but and in terms of communities. But I'm talking to you from Milwaukee, which is one of the most segregated areas in the whole country, and our schools are very segregated. So the Milwaukee public schools are African American to a large extent, and there are some really high performing schools with African American scholars who are terrific, who are getting into the best schools, et cetera, with some white students who haven't fled the city. But there is very, very little true cross-cultural being together. You know, everybody is segregated, is separated. And I wonder what that does to this whole notion of understanding somebody else's life and understanding poverty. We just live where we feel most comfortable. And it seems to me as though it's a lost cause unless we start living in the same neighborhoods and going to the same schools. What do you think, Norma, or am I off base with that?
No, I think you hit it. You know, I mean, just what you described is the situation that we were talking about before the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I love that you pointed that out because so many people don't recognize that. And I'd say at many levels we need to pay attention, you know, at our voting level, because everything that we vote into place is what we see in place. You know, for people that truly are concerned about integration, a mixing, diversity of peoples and what that brings, then it takes some action to make it different. I want to quote something from Debbie's book that I just love.
Okay.
She says, "At this point, the only thing needed for racism to continue is for good people to do nothing."
Mm-hmm.
I said that. I think that says it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think you're right. We want to hear your poem, too. We'll get to that. We're continuing our conversation in just a moment. We're talking about the White Privilege Conference taking place in Madison next week. Go to our Facebook page. There's more information about it. The Kathleen Dunn Show, we have two guests. You were just listening to Norman Johnson. Norman is a poet, a healer, a teacher, a performance artist, and she's going to be reading her poem and being involved in the conference, as is our other guest, Debbie Irving. She is the author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Debbie is a racial justice educator and writer. Here's how you reach us. One line open, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Terry in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have kind of a different situation than I generally hear addressed, and perhaps then others won't agree with me that it's a situation, but I feel it. I grew up white in Milwaukee with a single mom in the Milwaukee public school system. I felt both early on some of the segregation and some of the challenges of being the only white kid. And I also felt that fade as I spent a few years around the same people. And I felt like the kids around me, pretty much we were all kids. There were times, of course, when that wasn't the case, changed schools, things like that. But I certainly experienced a lot of things on ground level. I experienced going to a school where the challenges were strong enough that I know that in knife fights there would be a kid bleeding on the floor and the weapon would just be palmed away so that nobody would ever find it, nobody would ever find the evidence. And therefore, there wouldn't be as much that could be done about it. And this is from my mother having a background on her side of white privilege. Not that the white privilege was afforded on that side, but it was felt that it should be. So I felt accepted in schools and by my friends. And then I started being talked to by my mother about the way I spoke and about how I was going to be discriminated against because I sounded like a little black girl. And being enraged at my mother because she was prejudiced and her trying to tell me, I'm not, but the rest of the world is going to judge you. And then we get out and we get out into the suburbs. And then I'm walking around as a little city girl. And then I had all sorts of challenges there with being ostracized and being beat up on because I was the little city kid.
Where are you now? Where are you now, Terry?
Okay, I'm sorry. So, in any case, I'm now in a similar situation with my kids.
Uh-huh.
We're back in Milwaukee. My son has Asperger's, so he's socially challenged anyway. And he says things in the middle of the store like, Mommy, is that guy going to rob the place? Because he actually asked the guy, and the guy's black. But it's not because the guy's black that he asked. It's because I just had a conversation with Liam about not robbing, with my son was not robbing the place. So now we're in a black community, and that thing about racism and power, when we're being socially ostracized, it feels like there's power.
Okay, let's get a response. Who wants to take this? Norma, Debbie, whoever speaks first.
Norma, you want to toss a coin, or are you?
Terry, could you say what your concern is? Because I got a little lost.
Yeah, can you put it in a sentence here, Terry? What's your concern right now?
Okay, my concern is being judged on both sides. We're in a black community as white people.
All right, being judged on both sides.
Okay. Norman, you want to take that? Do you want me to?
Why don't you go for it? I have to think about that for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could probably do a whole show on the scenario that you just described. There is so much in that one story. A couple things I heard. The first thing I heard was that as a child, how willing the children in your classroom were to just all be friends. And I think that that's an innate human leaning. And I think that we get that socialized out of us. We get racialized, and we are trained to look at other people as other. And that I think that that's where the tension comes from, that makes that made your mother want to make sure you didn't sound like an other, but you sounded like who she wanted you to be, which was in a box that she knew would have some privilege attached to it. And then what happened in the grocery store with your son is otherized because he's not a typical learner, typical behaving child. And you understand that there's this otherization and tension around race. And so when your son says something that has origins from someplace other than racial, but you understand it's going to be perceived at as racial, you know, it stirs anxiety in you. So the arc I hear in all you said is, children are very willing to and very accepting and very loving of anyone, and yet we are all socialized to think of each other as other in all these different ways.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Lori in Winona. Hi, Lori.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Yes, this is a good follow-up to your previous caller. I was born and raised in Southeast Kansas, very segregated, still is. My mother was ill, and we had a maid who was African-American. I'm the youngest of five kids, and she took care of me and would take me to the side of town where all of her friends and family were, who were all African-American. So I basically grew up not really seeing color, and I didn't realize that I was white and had this privilege till many, many years later. And sometimes I almost feel like I have survivor's guilt.
Mm.
It's so frustrating to explain to other people that we have white privilege as white Americans. They don't want to even believe me.
Debbie.
Yeah. I'm almost speechless because that term survivor's guilt triggered something in me, because it's very easy to feel guilt around this, because once you do understand the way the system simultaneously advantages white people while disadvantaging everyone else, as a white person, it's really easy to get tripped up in guilt on that. But I think that our job as white people, you know, we heard John call in from his college campus. It really bothers me the extent to which the educating of how racism works in America falls way too heavily on people of color. And this is what really motivated me to read my book and set up. I have an interactive educational sort of racism 101 website, because I feel that white people really need to take on this burden of helping to educate other white people how racism works. And that guilt really can get in the way. And I don't have a magic answer for how to get beyond the guilt, except that I can tell you, for me, really putting my energy into educating and not pushing other white people, but trying to find out where they are and ask them questions. As Norma said, just planting a little idea, one conversation at a time, that helps people think a little differently. So I would really encourage you to put your energy into helping other white people understand you can't convince people when they don't have the education.
Thanks, Lori, very much for the call. We didn't get to your poem. I don't want you to just do part of it. Can we put it on the website? Can we put your poem on the website?
Norma? The radio station website?
Yeah.
Sure can.
Thank you. We will do that, because
yes.
I would hate to have you do a minute of it and then we can't do any more of it.
Yeah, and there's also the YouTube video.
Oh, there we go.
So I'd encourage that one.
Thank you. That's what we'll do. So you two are going to be in Madison along with a whole lot of other people taking on these issues next week, huh?
Yes.
Good. What happens? We have about a minute left. What happens that makes this so important for both of you?
Oh, Norma, you want to answer that?
Sure. You know, at one point at the conference, one of the conferences I was at, I went up to Eddie Moore Jr., who is the founder and director, and I went to just approach him to say thank you, and I burst out into tears.
Oh.
Just, and I didn't even know where it came from. Just, it was like this release
that, oh my God, there's a place like this.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And when I tell other people of color about the conference, first they think it's a joke.
Mm.
White privilege conference? Ha, 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 you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, really? Really, you know? And the majority of the attendees are white.
Mm.
People that actually come to learn
mm-hmm.
what they did not know.
Yeah, that's great. We need to say goodbye. Thank you both so much for being with us. It was really a great hour. The White Privilege Conference next week in Madison. Information on our website. We will also post Norma's poem. We'll do the YouTube version so you can see her in action. Our thanks to Debbie Irving, who is the author of Waking Up White. And we also thank Norma Johnson, poet, healer, teacher. Marika Suval produced this hour. Thanks, Marika. KP Whaley, our on-air producer in Milwaukee.